Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the man, the myth, not the darkness, and the legend, Mr. Spencer Williams.
Yes, I live in the light.
I don't know about that, but we'll go with it. We'll roll with it. And also, speaking about the darkness, we have with us intern manager / managing intern Amy.
So excited to be here. Yes.
That was like her Valley Girl accent.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Let's do this. No, I didn't want to do the movie again.
Yeah, she is here to do this next movie as we are continuing our month-long conversation of cosmic horror in Cosmic Horror-tastic as we discuss the recently... Actually, it's not recent, sorry. The film for this week, which is 1997's Event Horizon. So stick around as we dive into that and hear Amy's grunts and groans and, all the wonderful tidbits we got. But before we do, Spencer, give us some opening credits.
Tune into brand new episodes each and every week.
Week.
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. Also, we're on Blue Sky at Filmosophers Podcast.
That's right. Head on over to our website where we have tons of great stuff, allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills and chills, spoopities, and all the goodness. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmosophers and give us a like or a subscribe and listen in. Tell us what you think. Feel free to fill out the comment section down below. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please. Please. I saw this movie again. Please.
Okay, we'll give all the social links at the end of the episode. That's right. We are excited to continue this month's celebration of all things spooky as we are continuing our thoughts on the cosmic horror genre for the month of October. But interestingly enough, speaking of horror and horribles, things. We were just having a conversation here a second ago, and so we were trying to figure out. Yeah, obviously, we try to fill this space right before we get into reviews with meaningful conversation. We try to figure out ways to bring something bright and educational, or at least academic, or what? To a certain extent, a sense of intelligence to the table when it comes to this space.
Yeah, that's so, what all those game shows were about.
Yeah.
That's what that was.
Exactly.
I feel like that the meme of the...
The meme, the meme?
Yes, the so, meme of the minion that's like, what?
So, speaking of what, so we were having a conversation right before air, and we were talking about that, of course, like I said, and so we were trying to discuss something as far as what to talk about, and Amy... as wonderful as she is, made some kind of reference to a joke or something that sounded very similar to, if you are a child of the 90s, something that Jerry Seinfeld may have done in a stand-up that he usually does before and after an episode. Spencer, you recall these episodes?
Yeah.
So I immediately said, what are you, Jerry Seinfeld or something?
No, you just said, are you Jerry?
No.
Yes.
Spencer?
Ooh.
That's where we got confused.
No, that's
because
not.
Because I heard Jerry.
I actually don't remember.
I remember because it was so much of a pivot. I said, what are you, Jerry Seinfeld?
I feel like you did, though.
Yeah, I did. And she immediately says, what did you say? Yeah, I'm going to call you out on this.
No, I'm trying to remember because I heard you said Jerry.
I said Jerry Seinfeld.
And it did not sound like Seinfeld if you said Jerry Seinfeld.
Here's the wonderful thing that's going to happen.
Thing is,
at the end of this episode,
Steve take over for him.
Here's the wonderful thing. I'm going to pause it here and then I'm going to put the cut because I was recording that entire time and I'm going to put it right here.
Say Seinfeld. He's so in trouble.
It does say Seinfeld.
Oh, we'll find out. Dear listeners, enjoy this brief moment. They call it spooky, but is it really?
What are you, Jerry Seinfeld? Cut it out.
Gosh. I can't be Steve. I gotta be Jerry.
Who's Steve?
Who's Steve?
The guy that took over for Jerry.
So obviously, like I said, it said Seinfeld.
You're just going full.
I know, because I know without a doubt that it said Seinfeld. So,
cuts to later, like late night. He's like, "Crap, I didn't say that." Oh, no. He has to like pull paste it in.
Exactly. No, I it'll be fine. Trust me. I am 100% certain that I said Seinfeld because it sounded like something. Like if I would have just said, "What are you, Jerry?" or something, I would have felt like that was a very George Costanza kind of thing to say.
Which would be on brand.
It would be if I was trying to emulate that. But the fact that her joke sounded so much like Jerry Seinfeld, it would only regard to say the whole name. And so what did you say, Amy?
I said, didn't Steve take over for him? And you both looked at me and went, Steve? Who's Steve?
And of course, Amy, if you don't know, operates on a whole other brainwave at times.
A very nice one. It's very nice here.
No, it's not because we were
my brainwave. Me and this orchid leaf say no.
Why are you taking leaves off of the plant?
It's on the table. It is already finished what it was doing with its life. Okay. It jumped ship.
Yeah.
Well, either way, we were just like, what the heck are you talking about? And even Spencer at this point was like, yeah, Amy, I'm actually completely lost. And everybody knows, if you've listened to the show long enough, Spencer will do everything he can to back Amy up just so that she doesn't feel like she's getting picked on.
Not all the time.
Spencer.
And sometimes when you do pick on me, it's really funny. So I appreciate it.
But
it's never out of malice.
I would say 95 to 99% of the time, Spencer usually does come to the aid of Amy.
It's a solid A. Agreed.
It is.
It is a solid A.
But this was probably the first time I've ever seen Spencer give a side eye to Amy and say, what? And it was absolutely like, yeah.
I didn't know what was happening because like I started like going happening. Through like memories. I'm like, okay, what other shows were Jerry Seinfeld in?
I don't recall any other shows that he was on that was.
Because mostly the biggest thing after Seinfeld is the B movie.
He also did and what was Coffee and Cars with Comedians.
Oh yeah, that's
but
later,
yeah, though. That's not really like quotable. We're not worrying about that one.
Yeah.
Like obviously, the sentiment of that conversation was geared towards the television series known as Seinfeld, which was on NBC, which ran for God knows how long.
So
of course, we're sitting here and like, who the heck is Steve? Like, why would you say Steve? And what did you say? Walk us through the logic you had here going on, because I'm still baffled.
So as we recall, I did not hear the Seinfeld part of Jerry, and I heard Jerry, and somehow that triggered Jerry Springer. And then I said, Jerry Springer, when his show was done, had a bodyguard on his show named Steve.
And then Spencer immediately said, he goes, oh, you mean Steve Wilco?
Yeah,
everybody knows about Steve Wilco, and he had his show at the same time
as
Jerry Springer, because it was an offshoot.
No.
Yes.
You didn't think that he did, though.
No, I didn't.
you literally thought that he went on to take over for Jerry Springer.
Yes.
And that Jerry Springer had already been off the air at that point.
Correct. I still believed it.
And the problem is, obviously, again, for everybody who knows Amy, Spencer, why are you looking all bewildered?
I didn't realize the Steve Wilco show was still on.
It's still on the air. Yeah.
That's amazing.
But if you know Amy to any extent or have listened to her at any length of time on the show, you know that Amy likes to speak with a very matter-of-fact mentality.
18 seasons.
Yeah.
Woof.
The man is making money.
Woof.
And
you are 100% correct. It was another 11 years until the Jerry Springer show had concluded.
Yeah.
From when he debuted.
So you were wrong.
I said that Spencer was right.
No, you said Spencer was right, but what about you being wrong?
Excuse me?
Were you wrong? Were you incorrect? In everything just right now.
What
both
are you
in your
to
statement
do?
of I'm just trying to see if you have the capability of saying you were incorrect.
I've repeatedly said it, and there is multiple on time. We had so many episodes.
The fact is,
there's a lot.
Did you watch the Steve Wilco show?
No.
Or Jerry Springer?
Once or twice for Jerry Springer, to be honest.
I mean, all had sick days as kids.
But it was like a little bit. And then I was like, this is just too weird. And then I would switch to Maury. Like everybody knows. Yeah, everybody Maury. Knows where to go. You go to Maury.
No. I don't know about that.
Listen, that was the life of a kid who was sick at home and all of the cartoons had turned off.
Yep. You were watching grown-up TV at that point after like 9 o'clock and you had the morning news and then you had whatever else was coming
Price
on.
Right.
The game shows in the morning and then you had the sitcoms that were like either in syndication and then you had the talk shows.
No, it was talk shows and then it was General Hospital, Days of Our Lives, As the World Turns.
I was not watching.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
I mean, that sounds like all just like, again.
Price is Right was where it was at, where I was like, yeah, I can do this.
For me, it was always in the morning. You had the cartoons and then the news. Mm-hmm. And then you had the game shows in the morning. And then you had the sitcoms that were in syndication because that's when 90210 and what is that other show?
Man, he had recent stuff.
Right. He was cool.
I know. That's nice.
We didn't have recent shows? 90210 in the morning?
Yeah, we didn't have any syndicated TV shows out here.
I did, but they were old.
Like I Love Lucy, right?
I Love Lucy and Leave It to Beaver.
That is great. Yeah. And what was it? Andy Griffith.
Oh, yes.
There used to be this like Canadian or Wisconsin show that was on.
I'm sorry. Was this when you were in Texas or out here?
We're finding out it's a lot of Texas.
Okay.
They got cool stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I literally would catch up on 90210 old episodes in the morning.
We didn't get that.
I didn't watch that show.
Neither did I.
Because I didn't get reruns.
But the thing is, and then it transitioned over into the talk shows because the talk shows ran up into the 3 o'clock hour where the afternoon cartoons would start.
Because that's when Ricky Lake came back.
Exactly.
On.
Yeah. Or you had the Ricky Lake in the evening because then they would also start showing them. They would show talk shows.
Like she had a different show or the same.
I'm pretty sure they were showing on his time because we would have not Sally Josie Raphael, which is very close. But we would have Oprah was like the final talk show I would remember for us out here.
Did you only watch like ABC or something or like the was it either ABC, NBC or CBS?
Okay, well, you have to be
and
fair.
Fox 40 on occasion.
In this area specifically.
We had a very small window.
There was I don't know what it was like with Channel 3, but it was like not happy during most of the day.
Yep. Uh-huh. Until
like night, unless you got into a very specific position and like holding like the antenna, you could probably get it on the other day.
And then, but then you had to like, I even had gotten so far as the tin foil where I was like, please tin foil, support me in my endeavors. It didn't work.
This is a complete departure of what we've been talking about because obviously it's an Amy thing. So usually it does go awry. But here's my question for the table. What is the weirdest apparatus setup you have ever had for a set of bunny ears? Like, because I remember my family. So when we had bunny ears before, obviously everything went digital, but like having bunny ears on the TV, I remember the weirdest things we would have. Like we would buy those Walmart, like, oh, increase your antenna's capability of catching signal by doing this or adding this. Like it was usually like some kind of weird, you know, as seen on TV kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think the one that has always stood like has set up really well for us was we had this speaker wire that connected to the actual thing on the back for the antenna. And then we would stretch it all the way. And it just so happened that the TV was along the same wall that, you know, catty corner to the front door. And then we ran it outside.
Whoa, that's hardcore.
Yeah. So
with the speaker wire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey.
What about you, Spence? You looked a little.
No, it's just regular TV buddy ears with or without tinfoil. And then occasionally me adjusting the tinfoil up and down to see if there is a better sweet spot than at the tip.
Ames?
It depends on which season of Amy you talk to, because I did have at one point the stereo speaker wire, but that was when I was a teenager and I had ran it up the wall and split it. And I was just like, please work, for the love of God, please work. But the one that I had for a very long time was one of the bunny ears that had the little weird round circle in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
And then it had the two that would go out, and then it had tin foil, and then you would crunch and uncrunch the tin foil at the edges to try to get it to work. But literally, I would have one that was basically at, like, I would get it almost at, like, if we're talking time frames, it would be, like, at 4:35. Like, I was trying to, like, get it down, and then I hung it on the wall.
One last question, then we got to move on because we're taking way too much time on this. Thanks a lot, Amy.
You're welcome. Content. Look at that.
Yeah, was, 90s content. Yeah.
Was there anybody in the house that was typically the antenna holder for certain shows or certain time slots? Like, I know it sounds weird, but like there were times where I would have to send Benny or I would have to get up and like I would literally stand in front of the TV, hold the one of the antennae, and then be able to watch the TV there because it just worked better.
Mm. Yeah,
but
because you became the extra person.
You all of a sudden became like the extra conduit for like great signal. It's like Bobby's World only flowed through me or something.
Yeah, I did do that a lot when I was watching Telemundo.
Telemundo? Yeah.
They are the only ones that had DBZ on. And even though it was in Spanish and I couldn't speak it, I still wanted to watch it.
Ahora on Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's weird how much that channel tends to have those small gems. But yeah, that was always one that was never really fully. And we never really had a right to really, not a right, but like a need to kind of have it dialed in because there wasn't really much on it that we saw. What about you, Ames?
Well, traditionally, when it was just my brother and I at home, I tried to make my brother hold it and it didn't work out well. So we would jerry-rig chairs and random things and figure out ways to hang it from certain things, but with like extra, because they gave us wire coat hangers, children, at the dry cleaner. You would just take the wire coat hangers and we would make, essentially try to use the wire coat hangers hanging off the bunny ears.
I never used the dry cleaners as a kid. Did you ever?
No.
My dad's in the military.
Usually the dry cleaners, the wire hangers usually came from clothes that family gave you.
Yeah. So just,
yeah.
I was
we're not.
My dad got his uniforms pressed. It wasn't my fault.
It was super fancy though when you got a wire coat hanger with the paper on it.
Yes.
Oh,
it was
with a little roll at the bottom.
Exactly. That's, and you're like, oh, cool. Yeah, we never got those.
What?
Well, I never got those. Like, regularly,
I
never
didn't
got
them. Personally, these were from my dad's uniforms. We would literally take his stuff out of the closet and we would use them and try to hang it and get it as close to the window as possible. And then it would work a little bit better. Just a little bit.
Well, speaking of reaching out and connecting, where that does bring us to our conversation of the evening. And that is our conversation as we continue this cosmic horror-tastic month. Our conversation on 1997's Event Horizon. This movie has been wildly acclaimed as one of the foremost cosmic horror sci-fi films of the last couple of decades. A lot of people have really... It's a very divisive film. Like, people either hate it or they love it. And it's really interesting, based on the subject matter of the movie, how you're going to go which direction. So we got a chance to check this movie out in a response to the celebration for this month. And so Amy was absolutely thrilled.
So thrilled. So much so that I continue to cry about this month and this movie in particular.
Yes, very much so. So before we dive into this wonderful conversation, Spencer, why don't you give us the official synopsis goodness?
In the year 2047, a group of astronauts are sent to investigate and salvage the long-lost starship Event Horizon. The ship mysteriously disappeared 7 years ago on its maiden voyage, and with its return comes even more mystery as the crew of the Lewis and Clark discover that the real truth behind its disappearance and something even more terrifying.
Directed by Paul Anderson and written by Philip Eisner, the film stars Lawrence Fishburne, Sam Neill, Kathleen Quinlan, Jason Isaacs, Sean Pertwee, and Jolie Richardson.
Yay, Jolie!
Couple key pieces about the movie. Although the film was met with mostly negative reviews and a disappointing box office result at the time of its release, it amassed a considerable cult following over the years. Director Paul W.S. Anderson said that the movie's cult status was predicted to him, years before by Kurt Russell. Anderson screened Event Horizon before they started work on 1998 Soldier, and Russell said, quote, "Forget about what this movie's doing now. In 15 years' time, this is going to be the movie you're glad you've made," end quote.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is interesting because, you know, somebody like Kurt Russell, you don't really think, when it comes to a lot of actors, you don't really think like they have a kind of good gauge on what's going on in the future of the industry. But for somebody like Kurt Russell, obviously, I'm pretty sure that's kind of his bread and butter, because a lot of his movies do eventually become those cult classics, like Escape from New York, Escape from L.A., Big Trouble in Little China, huh?
Oh, Soldier, because you didn't he? You say sorry? I was paying not paying attention, oh, wow. So I apologize. Okay.
My God. Either way,
yeah, Soldier.
Kurt Russell's. I mean, even Stargate. Kurt Russell was one of the performers in Stargate, and you know that didn't really get a lot of acclaim at the time. Although it was a huge budgeted movie, it did get a cult, reach cult status at a certain point in time, especially when the arise of the Stargate series kind of revitalized and came about. So, it makes sense in the aftermath if you think about it. So, another key piece of information: from green light to completion, the film only took 10 months, an unusually short time for such a complex and effects-driven film. You take a look at everything that goes on in this movie, and I would have never have thought that it only took 10 months.
Yeah.
This movie seemed to, like, especially with a lot of the, with all of the conception and I guess, visuals that are in this movie, it's really kind of hard to understand how it only took that long.
Right.
You know? But I mean, hey, if they were able to be able to knock that out in 10 months, I mean, it really said something about the direction and the guidance for this film. Especially if you're thinking about like the writing in itself, like having to build that and create that mythos for this particular movie. That's, really something else. And last but not least, having just done a PG-13 movie with, as 1995's Mortal Kombat, Paul W.S. Anderson was very keen to do something more mature and gruesome. This is actually why he turned down the chance to direct 2000's X-Men.
Whoa.
So he was actually on the docket to direct it, but he wanted to do something a little bit more grown up, I guess. So,
Which I guess I kind of understand that based on where comic book movies were at that point in time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were practically non-existent.
Yeah.
Outside of Blade and then the seen unseen Fantastic Four movie and the Hoff as Captain Nick Fury, and then
that's right,
and then Dolph Lundgren as the Punisher. No, Dolph Lundgren was somebody.
Wasn't he in that Conan movie or something?
He was, but he did a Marvel film. I believe he did the Punisher. If we had an intern, I'm pretty sure
I'm checking.
As well as that 80s Captain America movie. So it's just really interesting to think about. Can you imagine the trajectory of where comic book movies, what was it?
He was Punisher, you're
he
right.
He was the Punisher, okay. Because I believe he like even dyed his hair black for that movie.
He did.
Can you imagine the trajectory of like comic book movies if instead of Bryan Singer, you had Paul W.S. Anderson start this thing off? That would have been really, really interesting. So, but yeah, obviously we are excited to talk about this movie. This movie is definitely one that had to be on the list. And as we discuss it, obviously we want to make sure that everybody knows that as for the length of time this movie has been out, over 25 years, spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about everything because Amy loves to talk, especially about this movie.
So much about this movie.
So, let's talk about expectations, because I know we had to have some. Because it's always a interesting perspective to have when you go into a movie you haven't seen in a while. And I know I haven't seen this movie in a while. I don't know about you, Spencer.
Same. I haven't seen it since like the 90s, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to say the last time I saw it was probably early 2010s.
Mm.
But then that may have been because it was on Sci-Fi at that point.
Mm.
But I've seen it prior to that, but like the last time, I want to say. Amy, when was the last time you saw this movie?
Well, I'm even checking to give it the proper. It was in the 2000s, which I did not want to see.
I believe it was just last year, wasn't it?
If it was last year, it was, I'm assuming, yeah, between, I can't tell because the internet's not letting me find out. If it was 2022 or 2025. So either way, I've seen it within the last couple of years. And no, I still don't like it.
I was going to say, I could have swore it was like in the last year or two.
Then it's probably the 2022.
No, the last year or two.
No, I did not see it in 2024. That one I can assure you, I would have rage quit that so fast.
I don't know. I might want to double check that.
I am. Proceed forward. I will continue to look.
Let's talk about expectations. Let's start with you, Spence, since it seems like it's been the longest for you. What were some of the expectations of you going into this with the mentality that, you know, it is a cosmic horror film?
Okay. So first things first, like I was trying to like remember the first time I actually watched this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I really couldn't remember. Like, it was just so long ago. And then I started the movie. And then I instantly remembered exactly when and where and what I was doing. Because I had walked out into the living room. My dad was already watching the movie. It had just started.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I saw a spaceship. And young Spencer loved spaceships. And so I was like, what's this movie? What's going on out here? And he's like, oh, I'm watching a movie. And I'm like, can I watch it? And he's like, yeah.
Yeah. You're putting your dad on blast right now. He's like, Spencer, no, don't.
He did warn me. He's like, eh, it might be a little scary. I'm like, eh, that's fine. I've seen Star Trek. How scary can it get?
I've seen Star Trek.
Yeah, I was not a horror movie kid, so I had no idea what I was walking into. So at the time, like, you know, it was a bit intense, but I remember liking it a lot once I got over, like, through it.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back to it, I was expecting to, you know, come back to a movie that I liked as a kid and maybe either find funny lines in it or just, you know, something that I liked.
Still, yeah.
You know.
Okay. Okay. Ames, you able to find what you're looking for?
No.
Okay.
Which makes me more frustrated because I suffered through this before.
What were some of your, I'll tell you what, I'll give my expectations. Yeah. Since I'm second on this list as far as the most recent watch. Expectations, honestly, I was anxious to see kind of how well this aged because I didn't realize, I remembered that it was very like effect laden, like it had a lot of special effects in it, but I didn't realize it was from 1997. Like that's like what, a year or two after Toy Story.
Yeah.
So I was hoping it aged well, number one. And then number two, I was hoping that the story still kind of held weight. Like it wasn't just a movie that had sci-fi horror elements, but it actually had a story built into it. Because obviously, when you look at movies back then, like sometimes, and that goes for any movie, sometimes a movie can be made just for the fact that it can be.
Yes.
Not without any purpose or drive or goal. Like sometimes someone's like, hey, I got money. Let's throw $10 million at something. Okay. And they make a movie, you know, I was really hoping that this didn't fall into that category and that the story still held up. Like I wanted to make sure this wasn't something that I just liked for the sake of, or that I was interested in watching it for the sake of like what other people were watching. Like, oh, other people were like, oh, it's a cosmic horror film or it's scary because of this, that. So it's great. Like, no, it has to have merit. There has to be like a really good, you know, the holy trinity, if you will. Great directing, great performers, great writing. Yeah. You know? So any luck over there?
Nope, but I'm still going with 21 or 22 that I saw it because Lord knows I still didn't want to see it. And shout out to a Steve's for forcing me to see it. So if we're talking expectations going into this movie, I didn't want to do it again. I didn't. If you don't know, can't tell by how excited I am, I did not want to do this movie again. I didn't want to do this movie in the first place. But you know what? I was seduced by Sam Neill and it's a spaceship. And I was like, it's a spaceship movie.
See, and that's what gets everyone.
It gets you. You're thinking, oh, it's Sam Neill. And you start out and you're like, oh, they're flying in space. Oh, the music's pretty good. Like it does. It knows. So after having already gone through that once, I was not excited to go through this again. And I have been loudly protesting that I was being forced to go through this again. And I'm still mad. And yeah, I watched it again.
So yeah, she watched it again just like the rest of us. And so
with my eyes, my hands over my eyes at certain parts where I was like, uh-uh.
So let's talk about first impressions right outside the gate. Let's start with you, Spence, since it's been, you're the furthest one out.
This movie is freaking awesome.
Yeah.
It's so much dramatically better than I remember it being. I was kind of blown away. I was just super locked into this movie. I had a fantastic time.
Right?
Yeah.
I echo that 100%. Like, this movie absolutely has a stunning story. It's got perfect horror elements. And it's got Sam Neill, Lawrence Fishburne, Jason Isaacs. You got so many people in this movie that just are actors early in their prime. And you're like, or at the peak. Maybe not. I don't know. Sam Neill's still pretty great. And Jason Isaacs is still pretty great.
Still good stuff.
But you get a chance to see them when they're younger and more agile, I guess.
I know. Like, Lawrence Fishburne in this, I was like, he looks like a baby.
Right? I'm like, he looks nothing like he did in The Matrix. So yeah, I'm just like,
which is weird seeing as how it's just a couple of years later.
Yeah, seriously. It is, right? Just 2 years earlier.
Because
he must have,
like, that came out in 99, right? Didn't that mean that they would have had to start filming, like, shortly after this movie came out? Well, I guess that depends on when they started filming. Well, I mean,
remember, 10 months. Yeah. So.
So at most, like, it would have to be, like, 2 or 3 years.
What did he do then?
He just shaved his head.
Yeah, he shaved his head, but he shaved his head. No offense, but it looks like he shaved his head and then, like, bulked up. Mm-hmm. Like, because he looks bigger.
Maybe he did, because some of those fight scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In The Matrix, specifically.
Yeah. I either way, like, I feel like the people in this movie, it was like time capsules for a lot of these performers. You know, even like Jolie Richardson, which we just saw in a previous review that we did, mm-hmm. In the Color Out of Space, mm-hmm. With Nicolas Cage. She's obviously, it's an older film, or it's a more recent film, so she's a little older, but seeing her at a younger age and seeing her at the time where I remember, like, when I think of Jolie Richardson, I think of her at that point in time, you know, in the history of cinema. It's so great seeing these people perform and be wonderful. And I feel like the story holds up and the effects hold up. Like, yeah. Everything in this holds up well. So we'll talk about this. But before we do, Amy, first impressions on your second go around.
I can't get a long sigh out of this because the noise is going to be like, no.
Exactly.
So there were... Because it's been, by the way, I actually found the text message when I was like, oh, yeah, we're doing Event Horizon next week. So no joke, I watched it fairly certainly almost like 3 years to the day.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's nuts. So it was 2022. I was correct.
Okay. It felt like it was sooner, but okay.
Nope. So
maybe you just complain about it a lot.
Listen, I think she does. Listen, on that, so we need to remember,
like, yeah,
I am an L7 weenie when it comes to horror films, even though I continue to try to broaden my horizons. And in broadening my horizons, I've realized there are certain things that I do not like when it comes to horror films, which is great because now I know in casting my net wide, I'm like, I don't want to do that one. I don't like that part. Please don't make me do this again. And even if I ask nicely, sometimes that is turned down with a big stick. In this case,
big stick.
In this case, after watching Event Horizon the first time, I had very, very strong feelings about it. In watching it the second time, there were sections of it where I really did appreciate. And also things that I still didn't really like, which is great because it says that I'm still growing and things that weren't right with me the first time sitting right with me the first.
Are still broken now.
Yes. Yes. All the therapy in the world has led me to this. No, really, when it came down to it, on my first impression this time, there was, I think I have more appreciation for the story that it was aiming to tell, as well as understanding and being more receptive to performances, as well as some of the set, like the set designs and some of the way things worked, because I was like, oh, I see what you did there. But then there are other parts that I was just like, nope, and my hand went up over my face, and I still don't care. Take that.
Okay. Well, jumping right in, let's talk about some of these performances. And I was starting to get into some of them, but I kind of stopped myself before we got into it. Obviously, we talked a little bit about Lawrence Fishburne. Lawrence Fishburne is amazing. Seeing him in a much more active role as opposed to, and honestly, it's just a sign of the times, honestly. He's such a different beast altogether. And what else is blowing my mind is the fact that you mentioned just 2 years later, he debuts as Morpheus in The Matrix.
Yeah.
And it's like either he went through that portal and came back and became this, or they bulked him up like crazy.
No idea what they did to that man.
Yeah, he looks huge in this, in the Matrix.
Huge.
But also a couple other folks to really highlight. As I mentioned, Jolie Richardson, phenomenal actress. Again, the visual of what I see her in my head, and I did mention this in the other episode, is the one where I see her in The Patriot, which is a Mel Gibson film. I don't know what the year was on The Patriot, but. But I know, 2000. So not too far off from when this one was made, about 3 years later. But either way, like she's younger. She's, again, more active. It's really great seeing her in this role. But I do have to say, like, my surprise performance that I really, really enjoyed, and I'll give you guys an opportunity to talk about Sam Neill, is Sean Pertwee. Sean Pertwee?
Pertwee.
Yeah.
What's fun about Sean is, just a little shout out, is that he is actually the son of John Pertwee, who was the third Doctor.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
There you go. Hey. It all comes up, Doctor Who.
Everything, it's all timey-wimey, baby.
Mm-hmm.
But I've loved his performances and a lot of the things that he does. He usually plays, like, he's done a lot in, like, dystopic type of movies. He was the main voice of Father, so to speak, in Equilibrium. So it's, yeah. And in this one, he's like this, like, catty, like, snarky punk type engineer, or no, he's a pilot in this one. And it's really great to see him in this, again, in this stage of his career. But were there anybody that you wanted to highlight, Spencer?
I mean, honestly, looking through the cast list, they're all great, to be perfectly honest. Like, there's not really anyone I dislike. Like, I feel like Sam Neill knocked it out of the park with his Dr. Weir, of just, like, you know, starting off as, like, this scientist who built a ship and was very interested in, like, recovering it. And then just the turn as, like, the ship starts corrupting him.
Yeah.
Like, that was pretty fantastic. And so different from Jurassic Park, which is, like, the only thing as a kid that I had, like, recognized him from. So it was really cool seeing him like this.
It really is. Like, you think Sam Neill and you think, like, Dr. Grant.
Yes.
You think mm-hmm. somebody 100%. Like that, like, or, again, most people know him for that. And so it's very interesting to recognize that he has also done a lot of other films, specifically a lot of other horror films. He's in, I believe, the third Omen film. He actually mm-hmm. plays Damien grown up in I believe it was the 80s. It's like the Omen 3, 666 or something. I don't know, something like that. It's weird. He was also in another cosmic horror film that we'll be reviewing later on this month. And it begins to build this recognition that Sam Neill has done a lot of other things other than dinosaur movies. He even did Something Dawn. It's a vampire movie with Ethan Hawke. I don't know if you recall it, Spencer.
No, I do not.
I gotta look it up. I don't know what he's doing. but he plays like the main guy who runs. So it's in a society where everybody is pretty much, you know, a vampire, and there's very little people who are actually human, regular people.
Huh.
And so he is the, I guess, CEO of the corporation, as well as head of the community, who manage, like, the blood kind of aspect, like all the technology and whatnot, as well as, like, the blood creation, like how they feed everybody.
Because
I guess they no longer do, human blood or something. It's weird. It's gotta be here somewhere. I don't know. But, either way, it starred him and Ethan Hawke or whatever. But the fact that, like, you come to realize, like, Sam Neill has a very wide spectrum of films that he's done. Mm-hmm. Even movies like Hunt for the Wilder People.
Which is fantastic.
It's a phenomenal movie. He's just great. He's just wonderful. Ames, Was there anybody else you wanted to?
Richard T. Jones, who played Cooper. I love that he is the lifesaver. He is the man. There was brevity needed in this film, and I was so glad for his continued survival.
He had such a rough second half of this
movie,
though.
Oh, my Lord. The fact that he's fixing everything and then that he gets so far out that he has to purge his oxygen, and you're just like, dude, no. But he's okay. Like, he makes it. I continually was smiling. I had a good time just listening to him, and he doesn't falter. Again, the cast is so small because, again, we're in space. But he doesn't falter, and he feels cohesive and 100% like he's part of that backbone of this crew, that he is the man of every talent. He is our jack of all trades, and I love that about him.
You know what's crazy is that Richard T. Jones does eventually move on to other elements. Specifically, I remember seeing him in a few Madea movies.
Mm-hmm. He's in The Wood.
He is in The Wood. But I do recall, I believe, what is it? Why Did I Get Married is one of those movies that I see him I remember him prominently being in. And then Why Did I Get Married Too?
Which I remember that because I thought the title was absurd.
Yeah, Why Did I Get Married Too? It should have been like, Why Did I Get Married Again or something. But the fact is, like, he's got another great actor who's very wide spectrum, like moving out of that element of either being like not a leading character or like just a, you know, someone's opposite lead in like a romance or whatnot. Like he's really got a wide spread of movies. You know, he's done, like I said, the Why Did I Get Married movies, but he was also in like the TV show Hawaii Five-0. He was in the Godzilla film. He's done everything from like Hot Pursuit with comedy films to what was it that he did recently?
He's been in lots of stuff, and he's still he goes between TV as well as movies fairly seamlessly. I know he's in 2014's Godzilla.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Sorry, I was also reading up on the other person that I wanted to talk about too.
Who's the other person you wanted to talk about?
I wanted to bring up Jack Noseworthy, who's the guy that plays Justin, aka Baby Bear, who's comatose for most for half the movie. But the reason that I bring him up is because he is the individual giving officer at Broadway Cares at Equity Fights AIDS, and he's a producer for Real Women Have Curves that opened on Broadway, which is based on the movie, and it did really well. But in this, he's in that weird kind of space, and they call him Baby Bear, you know, on purpose. But some of it, you're just like, my guy, no, my guy, stop, please. It's going to be okay.
That's where I've seen him in. Okay. So outside of Event Horizon, I think the place I see him, I remember him the most is U-571, which if you guys hadn't seen that one, that's one about the German submarine that's boarded by American soldiers. He's in that movie, but it makes sense now. Okay. Wow. I didn't know any of that about him. Obviously that's really cool.
Surprise.
Great research.
Yeah.
Hey, look at that
for once. wow. Before moving on to the next one, Spencer, was there anybody else you wanted to highlight?
No, vaguely in the direction of everyone else. Good job.
Good job, everybody else.
I mean, yeah, again, it's a very small, a la You're in Space. It's a very, very small crew, no pun intended. And everybody equally bears the load of this film, like just across the board.
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, bears the load for this film, that does bring us to the story element of this movie. And obviously it's a constant conversation that we have, not just because it's not understood, but to clarify. You know, when it comes to cosmic horror doesn't always have to be in space. Sometimes it's in the mentality of, you know, the loss of sanity and things like that. And I feel like this movie combines the sci-fi elements and the cosmic horror aspect of what it means. Because you take a look at like classic cosmic horror, and most of it came about during a time when space travel or, you know, even being in space wasn't even a thing. So how do you create a cosmic horror entity or story without the understanding of like space travel or being in space? And so, again, that's where you understand that cosmic horror doesn't necessarily have to be about being in space. It's about the depravity of man and understanding that when insanity is you know, looming overhead, that the people who lose their leftover sanity are typically the monsters at the end of the movie.
I kind of thought that cosmic horror was more the exploration of, like, it's the insignificance of us as humanity, and then the madness that overtakes when we truly realize that there is nobody that is coming to save us.
That too. Again, it's
this encompass because that.
Because you have to remember, in that aspect, in that drive for understanding, it is the fraying sanity that is remaining for those that are surviving. Like, again, if you have somebody who's either in a house that's being bombarded by a cosmic entity that is creating a sense of chaos and confusion and insanity, and the last remaining quote-unquote survivors are those that have what's left of their sanity, that would be technically cosmic horror in that element. Same thing here, where you were saying, like, you know, waiting for somebody to save them, the idea of being left alone, isolated on a deserted space, where, no pun intended, deserted space, but in a ship that is so far out that the nearest person is light years away,
which is literally one of the things that Lawrence Fishburne brings up when he's like, we are 3,000 something odd clicks away from the nearest outpost. There is no one coming to save us. Like, there is the hallmarks within the story and clearly expressed dialogue that keeps reminding you, we are out here by ourselves. The only people we can trust is each other. And then the question becomes, can we even really trust each other?
Yeah, 100%. Like, and so that's kind of where we get with this story, where everybody who is already on edge because of the fact that they were taken off leave to go do this mission and are sent light years away from any semblance of home to show up to do a job where they have to rescue a tainted expedition that went awry because it tried to do something that technically wasn't really, based on physics, wasn't really allowed to happen. And they are the ones who are then, because then you get into the effort of, like, okay, the horror stories of this mission, and you are the ones who are sent to go find out, okay, is it really haunted? Is it really there? Kind of thing. It's like, on a certain level, you would almost want to say, like, Scooby-Doo is a sense kind of like cosmic horror, but for children.
But they always find out who did it in the end.
I said for children. Okay.
Plus, they're mostly people.
And gardeners. Old man Jenkins.
Again,
there was no old man Jenkins.
The real monster is us. You know, so, but no. And so you take this story and take the elements that are in, and, you know, it creates this beautiful mesh again of balancing the cosmic horror element of it with the sci-fi aspect. We are able to seamlessly see how well they interweave the idea of, okay, what if we built something that could potentially send us to the other side of the galaxy, but could also poke a hole through reality and send us to hell, you know?
Which I don't think anybody even remotely decided upon that when Sam Neill's giving his, what's the quickest distance between two points, and fold the paper.
Which, how many times have we seen that explained in that manner when it comes to, like,
in 1997, I don't recall that was a big thing that they were talking about. Nowadays, everybody's talking about folding the paper to get to pass through.
Yeah. But it just seems to be, like, the easiest way to explain how to.
It's actually a very good explanation.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Mm-hmm. It just, now that you've, like, if you've watched Event Horizon, now every other movie that incorporates that, it's like, you're like, yeah, but you could also go to hell. It's like, it's like Interstellar changes into a whole different beast now.
Stops becoming about family and love and about the demons that are pouring into this young girl's life.
Exactly. I mean,
technically, even this movie is about family. You have a mama bear, a papa bear, and a baby bear. And the family that was sent in to go save people and the disruption and destruction of their family.
And who would Goldilocks be in this scenario? The Hell Demons?
Samneil.
No.
Yes. Think about it. Think about it. Okay, real quick. This is my rabbit hole. So we have Baby Bear, who's Justin, gets hurt. Mama Bear is Peters, who left her kiddo. And then you have Papa Bear, who is actually Captain Miller, Lawrence Fishburne. Okay, there's our thing. Goldilocks comes in and jacks up everything. We're not talking about Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. We're talking about OG Goldilocks. Samneil is Goldilocks. Comes in, pokes at everybody's stuff, messes everything up, and leaves the house.
I think it's more of like a reverse Goldilocks situation. I feel like the bears wandered into Goldilocks' home.
No, it's more of the bears Goldilocks to her house.
And Goldilocks is Kevin McAllister, and he's pulling out all the stops, and like he and Jigsaw became, you know, made a family. Gosh. And they essentially were just like, welcome home, bees. And just I hear what you're saying. It's a very interesting analogy.
Well, even the nod to like the original, and I've been a big proponent of this, is that the original fairy tales are always warnings. So the fact that they even named the nicknames were like Baby Bear, I was like, nope. Baby Bear gets screwed over in the end. Either way, we shake the stick, the man's out. Like, mm-mm.
I mean, but again, they're not supposed to. The warning is supposed to be for Goldilocks. But, you know.
It's also for the bears. Lock your doors.
You're bears. Why would you need to lock your doors?
Because you don't know who's coming in.
First off, why are you owning homes as a bear?
They have caves.
We're millennials. We're still trying to own our own homes.
Now we're sad. No,
now I brought up bears and
I brought up the housing economy. So, in spite of the analogy that Amy gave, what I do want to say is I do love the fact that yes, you have very different attributes and very different character archetypes within the dynamic of the team. However, I think the one person that stands out the most for me that I just wasn't. And maybe it's because it's been so long since I've seen it, but the one that surprised me the most as far as being the most unique performance was Jason Isaacs.
100%.
Like, I feel like I've just gotten so accustomed to seeing him in Harry Potter that I'm just like...
Just Lucius Malfoy this? You're just like, sir, you're too evil. You're too evil and your son is evil too. Like, well, you didn't even pivot to Peter Pan where he was both Mr. Darling and Captain Hook.
In
there was a live action Peter Pan in the 2010s, and
that was because
Jonathan Howard did the score to that, and I love that because it's a really good score.
That's not the one with Hugh Jackman.
No, that's Pan.
Pan, yeah, yeah. I don't know about all that, but what I'm saying is Jason Isaacs really added something unique to the story. I felt like, if this was my first time watching this movie, I felt like Jason Isaacs was like the sleeper character. Like he was the sleeper archetype in terms of us part of the crew. Because everyone else seemed like, okay, everything was going nuts. Everything was crazy. They had opinions, things like that. But I felt like they were still going to be loyal to a certain extent.
Mm.
Jason Isaacs' character felt too quiet, too reserved, too... not logically figure out, okay, if I left my team and I just took the ship and left, I would be okay. I feel like that was definitely something on the radar that was a possibility for him.
See, here's the thing. He's like the medical officer, right?
Yeah.
But there's something about him, and I couldn't put my finger on, is it just because it's Jason Isaacs doing this character, or is there actually something deeper in this character that I'm pulling out?
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I could easily hate Lucius Malfoy, without a doubt. Yeah. I couldn't figure out midway through, obviously, like, once you get to a certain point in the movie, you're like, oh, okay, he's great. He's good. Yeah, he's cool. But, like, I couldn't figure out if I liked him or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so alarming. Because, number one, it tells me that Jason Isaacs is just still a phenomenal actor, mm-hmm. number one. But number two, it makes me question the type of character I acclimate to, because I don't know how his character is going to end.
Right.
And so if subconsciously I am seeing all these signs and he's actually a bad guy and I'm just like, oh, he's actually really good. Yeah. Okay. And then he turns out to be the bad guy. I'm like, oh my God, I've been on the bad guy side this entire time.
Well, I think that it really says a lot more about Jason Isaacs than it does about you, because like, to briefly pivot to another thing Jason Isaacs did, he was in Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, okay.
And he was one of the more interesting captains that showed up in that show.
Uh-huh.
Because like he shows up and he's like, okay, you seem like standard issue Starfleet captain, but now you're kind of acting weird and doing some shady stuff. Are you a good guy or are you a bad guy? Like, that just seems like it's kind of in a similar vein to this movie where you're like, what is happening? There seems to be a big backstory, but like, how is that like affecting the now?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Well, and it also doesn't really kind of help that when you saw him in The Patriot, he was Colonel William Tavington.
But yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Because he was obviously, and we mentioned that came out 3 years later, but you're right. Like, again, his roles that he makes up are typically bad guy roles, or they're very like analogous, like type of anti-heroes, or even just like, well, I don't know. Like, the majority of things that I've seen him in don't paint him in a good light.
Well, Batman Under the Red Hood, he was Ra's al Ghul Ra's al Ghul. Everybody's Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul. In Justice League's Gods and Monsters, he was Lex Luthor.
But these are, you're saying animated. This is like vocal performances. I'm talking about acting performances.
That's the thing, too. Even in those, you've already tied him, because consistently we see him in the... He's no longer questionable because it was...
He's in Under the Red Hood for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
He's not even a bad guy, really. He literally tries to resurrect the dead son of a Batman.
Literally 97 films, and the majority of them are ones that he ends up playing bad guys. So automatically, in this role, it's like he seems okay, but you're like, what's up with you, bro? What you doing? And then when he has to calm down Smith and he's got the scalpel to his throat, you're like, oh, dude, there's something wrong with you. But you can't put your finger on it. You can't figure it out. And you're like, is he, because he just says, when he introduces himself at the like the round table, when they're introducing themselves to Sam Neill, he goes, I'm DJ Trauma. And everyone just starts laughing. And you're like, was that a slip up? Or was that like, he's the trauma surgeon, like,
or he's DJ Trauma.
He's DJ Trouble. DJ Trauma. And I think that's kind of like a nod to Jason Isaacs, but also for the long tenure as playing Lucius Malfoy, there's no way that he's ever getting out from under the he's a bad guy, because I even forgot he was in a ridiculous Jackie Chan movie called The Tuxedo, and he was Clark Devlin, aka the master spy that was supposed to be Jackie Chan's friend. He wasn't a bad guy, but you're still like, he could be a bad guy. And like, that's just,
you've said bad guy a lot in the span of like less than 2 minutes.
If you're having a drinking game, which we don't encourage, you know, excess drinking, but if you were,
unless
<bad guy.
laughs> you're over the age of 21,
yes,
then that's on you. You're bad an
guy.
Adult.
You're not. That would make me a bad guy. It's interesting to see in relation to him as the choices of roles that he has continually taken on, which has changed the public's view of him in relation to characters that he is portraying that might not necessarily have antagonistic views.
Very true. Very true. Speaking of which, that also brings up, again, in that same retrospect, Sam Neill.
100%.
In his performance in this movie. Like, Sam Neill is somebody, again, we've seen him in Jurassic Park movies. He's the dinosaur guy. Yeah. He's the, you know, the velociraptor, scratch you here, dude. Like, he's that guy, you know? We're not used to seeing him in a role where the amount of logic that we're used to hearing coming from this particular man should be sound.
Mm.
And everything this man was saying was like, like, he created more questions about the littlest things of like, can you really do that? Is that like, oh, gravitational hallucinations and this and like, is that real stuff? Or is he just making this stuff up as he goes along? And it creates like this sentiment that you're like, I can't hate Dr. Grant. I can't.
That's the biggest problem because we see him as just, it's Dr. Grant.
Yeah.
And even then on the second viewing, I found it more so like I had already known what the outcome was going to be. But now on second viewing, I was listening for the lilt. I was listening for the change, the dismissing, the, oh, it's whatever. Like those moments were now more prevalent than my first viewing where I was like, but it's Dr. Grant.
You're safe with this guy.
Exactly. Yeah. We all were.
Their vision's based on movement. Come on. Just, you know, it's crazy how we've created these visuals, if you are, or this, I guess, vision of these particular people based on the characters that they've played. And in a movie where the most, I guess, expected vision of these particular actors are flipped.
Mm-hmm.
And you have somebody who, like Jason Isaacs, who is just a medical professional in, what'd you say it was again?
Trauma.
He's trauma. He literally just says, when he introduces himself, trauma.
Yeah.
But he's like the trauma surgeon, essentially.
Yeah. Like someone, like the medical officer on the ship, who is just, he just keeps to himself and is loyal to the captain. In fact, it sounded like he's the one who had been with the captain the longest.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, who is actually a good guy. And Sam Neill, whom we have known as, again, the dinosaur guy, who is slowly trying to entrap everybody to stay on the ship because the ship is sentient.
Mm. Yep.
And even after the ship makes him take out his eyeballs, he is still insistent on everybody staying on the ship.
She won't let you. We're leaving. She won't let you.
Like, it's insane. Like it, and on top of that, the visuals. Let's talk about the visuals.
Oh my God.
Like, like, so first off, like Sam Neill, kudos to the effects team and the makeup artists, everybody who did all the special effects on him to do the whole like eyes gouged kind of gag that he had, as well as the
stitches,
as well as at the end when you see all the cuts on him. Oh, and I'm sorry, you're right. The stitches where he actually, where it looks like he stitches up his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, when you see him where he has all those cuts all over his body and like a grid pattern, That's some really great work.
Yeah.
Like that team really pulled out whatever it is to make it happen in 10 months. Like you had to create the visuals, the ideas, the aesthetics, the execution on this for all of these scenes in less than a year's time. Like that's insane.
Yeah.
And you got to give kudos to where kudos are due. But on top of that as well, like the practical effect work, the actual physical design and effect of the entire ship, it was so crazy how the difference between what the Lewis and Clark looked like versus what the Event Horizon looked like.
Mm.
And the Event
because the Event Horizon had government money.
Well, but it also looked like, well, you know what? It's funny you say that because it looks like an old government building inside.
Yeah.
Like the colors of the floor, the colors of the wall, the design of the arches, even the cockpit area, like the bridge, whatever you want to call it. It all looked like it had a unique gothic yet government aesthetic to it, which is interesting to say because saying it out loud doesn't make sense, but it does if you look at it and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, this all makes sense.
But the one place that it really does sever from military-esque or government-esque on the Event Horizon is when you get to the, as who I think Justin called it, the meat grinder, which is supposed to protect the wormhole generator for any other, the gravity, what did Samuel call it? The gravity, whatever. It's a wormhole generator,
yeah,
essentially.
Basically. Yeah.
Because when you get in there, and this time I was actually able to focus on it, it carries like this medieval homage a la, like, it looks like something out of Dante's Inferno. It carries such like age and wear to it, and intricacy in the design, that everything kind of, even with like the grid on the floor with like the grating, it doesn't seem like it is so far removed from being something specifically from like the Dark Ages.
So,
which is so interesting to think of.
In the movie, it's called the Gravity Drive. But apparently in the script itself, the name of the gateway is actually called the Third Containment.
Ooh, that don't sound good.
Yeah.
So that sounds worse.
Yeah, it's really cool, and it's interesting the way they like the way it's posited in the script versus what it's actually called in the movie. But they also wanted to make sure, obviously, that the design of it looked very Hellraiser-esque. Like it looked like the what is that called? The something lament.
Third, is it the third lament?
No,
the something's lament.
Are you looking it up?
Yes.
I don't want to. It's the puzzle box in Hellraiser. But it's crazy how like that design in itself,
lament configuration,
the lament configuration. There you go. It's so crazy how the design of that entire section of the ship, including the meat grinder area, is completely different than the rest of the ship. Mm-hmm. Almost as if it was like, it was like cut and pasted on there from something else. But it doesn't take away from the fact that it still feels like it's a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, cause you take that long hallway, that long corridor that connects that drive to the rest of the other side of the ship. And it ultimately feels like that long hallway area is like that transition to what the rest of the government Gothic building ship looks like. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it almost feels like there's like some sort of side story where they stole some technology from somewhere.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Like that. And then when Sam Neill goes to correct like whatever they've decided they've initially gotten onto the Event Horizon, they're like, we just need to get the stuff and get out. They notice there's a power drain. And Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne go into the area where the gate is and it's still spinning and you're like, nobody should be in here. But he lifts up a panel and just climbs in and it's all, I love that set design because it's so crazy. It's like air ducts, but they're on crazy, I don't even know what, whatever. But it's literally like panels and all sorts of things and it's lit and it's green and you're like, okay, this is tight in here. Like what's going on though? And you really do feel that you're like, as much as Sam Neill's like, this is my baby, this is what I created. I was like, homie, what, where else you been? Like, what did you dig up? How'd you get here? Like, this seems way beyond you, like a million times.
Yeah, like that's what I was saying because it feels like somehow like he and some other government thing came across some sort of plans from some alien civilization because like. Even though, like, when he's in that air duct section and he, like, flips open some sets of revealed, like, some circuit boards, they look out of place, to be perfectly 100%. Honest. Like, almost intentionally, like, to try to, like, force two different design languages together. Mm-hmm. And I just found that really intriguing, even though the movie does not posit anything like that happening.
Yeah, and I think that was part of, like, the disconnect, too, when we see from moving from something that feels so ancient and it's still living in a, at this time, 2047, just in case you were wondering about our Stargate, our Captain's Log. But that using the long corridor to create that distinction between the two of those spaces, and even like where the lifeboat is, where the personnel are supposed to be living, versus the bridge too, which seems like that's a lot closer than the lifeboat. Does that make, like, am I just crazy about that?
No, like, isn't the bridge on the lifeboat section?
I thought so. I don't know because there's the way that, listen, if you guys have time to go stare at the ship design for the Event Horizon itself, it's interesting.
It's confusing in some parts too.
So I keep thinking,
why does the bridge have a glass?
I don't know.
That was crazy.
I really don't know. And it has the front of it, the glass legitimately looks like it's like a medieval helmet.
Yeah.
It's the same for thing. The medieval helmet.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, so we're just doing a lot of symbolism right now. But then even when we get to the big part, which is kind of like, I don't want to call it a MacGuffin, but it's the Latin that that Jason Isaacs has to discern. And then when he finally figures out what it actually says in relation to what, like It sounds like it's almost a callback to Dante's Inferno, which is over the gates of surprise hell. It says abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Mm-hmm. I think he says it's save yourself from hell or something like that is what Jason Isaacs translates. And so I'm like, the fact that somebody figured out a way to like slip in some Latin in their mania to give a warning on a CD. That CD, though.
I mean, like getting stuck like that. You scratched it if you're having to pull that hard.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah. I have a slight conspiracy theory now.
Ooh.
Because I've been thinking about this.
He's got a button. I'm excited. He's got to find the button. Button. Who's got the button?
Okay. So we know the ship has changed since it left, like the solar system or whatever, and came back. I think that containment unit has actually physically changed into something that it wasn't when it left. And the only person on that ship who would know is Sam Neill. And he's also the person who wouldn't say anything if it looked wildly different.
That's actually a really good point. Interesting. Yeah, you're right. Because technically, they don't know because it's all top secret, hush-hush, NSA, whatever. They wouldn't know anything about the inner workings of this ship.
Right.
Outside of what was divulged once they got close enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they weren't given like any kind of, you know, detail or any dossier.
No, they had the like show us of Sam Neill explaining to everyone, hey, this is what we're actually doing on this trip, because they hadn't even been told prior to him being on the ship what was going on.
Yeah.
Which the other thing too was the crew brings up that there were two rescue crews that went out for the Event Horizon and disappeared. They never came back. And they're going out too. So that raises the question of how long has the Event Horizon just been chilling over there around Neptune before this time Sam Neill's like, I should go out. I should go check on the baby. Like, that's...
Yeah, because that ship seems to have some range on its control ability.
100%. I mean, yeah, that's the spooky, I can reach you in the dark type of things, invade your dreams. And we're just like, no, thank you, sir.
Yeah, if it was at Neptune and it's like showing him things on Earth and that's super far. And I don't see it doing that to anyone else, even though we don't have a lot of people to work with.
I mean, and then we also have the issue of the people that seem to be, well, Justin didn't deserve it. Justin just got sucked in. He put his hand in. He was curious again. Another thing, we're not supposed to touch the weird thing.
Don't touch things in ships.
No, you just don't. The fact is, everybody else that seems to... I mean, Smith really was kind of like, he got the short end of the stick, no pun intended. But like Peters, she had something she was atoning for. Miller had something he was atoning for.
So real quick, this says there wasn't any rescue crews that went before.
But they said it in the movie.
I also thought there wasn't. I just couldn't remember enough to. Yeah,
it says there weren't any because it disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they weren't. Where were they going to go?
Because space is big.
Exactly. Space is very big. But that's the thing that like that's part of their complaint for the Lewis and Clark. Their crew is like, we were on vacation. You pulled us into this. We don't know why we're going out here, but you're sending us out this way for search and rescue. And Smith is the one that brings up that other crews had gone out and they hadn't come back. And if I'm going crazy, this is par for course with this movie.
It's Jerry Seinfeld all over again, Spencer.
That was on Earth, okay? This is, no. Mm-mm.
Well, either way, I love your conspiracy theory. I think it's actually a really good one. I never even thought to consider, like, in the archetype of this particular type of movie and the informed yet, you know, going mad scientist, that was something he had withheld from them. That's a very interesting perspective. Good job, Spence.
Yeah.
Let's roll over into any highlights or issues. So let's actually talk issues, because we've been talking a lot about highlights. Does anybody have any issues? Excuse me.
Yeah, I like that you just looked at me because, you know, I... Okay. So I think my big issue is that, again, I'm having to watch more cosmic horror, and I was in 2022, of October of 2022, forced to watch this the first time, and I didn't know what I was getting into. I feel the second time I experience this. I did not want to experience this again. And while I can applaud and appreciate the craftsmanship that went into this film.
You know we're not doing
film,
our final take.
No, I'm okay. Just saying this now. I didn't want to watch this again. So my complaint really comes to the fact that
you had to watch it again.
We I had to watch it again. And Eddie's fun fact of, oh yeah, you know that little tiny bit that they show you of the crew's log when they've all gone nutso. He's like, oh yeah, there's 10 extra minutes of that. What did you say? Like his deleted scenes or something?
Well, he deleted ultimately like almost an hour out of this movie, I want to say. So, but that was because like he had to really dial it back for it to just get an R rating.
Oh. To get an R rating. Yeah. I don't
Man,
want
to. What? Mm-mm. I would like to see that. Like,
I don't want unrated. To. I don't want to.
This movie, that'd be so cool.
I don't want to. I don't want to. This helped me hone in on the problems that I have or the horror films that I prefer to avoid. And this hit a couple of them all at once. So.
I apologize. 30 minutes. Approximately 31 minutes of footage was cut from Event Horizon, though only one deleted scene and some extended scenes were officially released on the special edition DVD. The other cut footage exists as raw material, including potentially graphic and violent scenes that was not included in the final movie.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Very cool.
See, this is what they should be doing with streaming services. Put all the extra crap back into movies or like have it be a toggle.
Yeah.
You want to see the unrated cut? It's here.
Yep. Exactly.
No.
Spencer, do you have any issues?
You know what? Not really. I'm very impressed with this movie. I had so much fun. It was a fun movie for me.
I actually liked it as well. I thought it was, I thought at certain points in time, certain performances were going to take me out of it. It's like, you don't really feel like, I don't know. It didn't really feel like they were part of the team or they weren't, I guess, because they're not military, are they? Right?
If they're part of some sort of weird organization that seems to be government.
Yeah, because they're being hired by the government, so I would assume they're being.
Well, and also they're calling like Captain and Lawrence Fishburne calls Jolie Richardson's character his XO, which is his executive officer. But the way he says XO is specifically to more military. But that's also why would you be pulled off leave?
Yeah.
So that would be military.
So, okay. So they were military. Okay. So like there were certain points where I was like, okay, you know, there's a couple of people who don't really feel like they're military type as according to other movies. I'm looking at Amy. I'm like, I don't have the vast experience as you do, but according to the movies, but they ultimately felt like the movie didn't get thrown out because of them. Like I didn't get thrown out of the movie because of that.
Yeah.
So honestly, I don't really have any complaints either. Mm. You know, it's interesting. But that does bring us to the roundtable question for this review. And it's a fun one. So I want your guys' thoughts.
Is it fun by your standards or fun by the table standards?
It should be fun by the table standards. We'll see. So if the roundtable question is, if the Event Horizon jumped universes and docked with another sci-fi ship, i.e. maybe the Nostromo from Alien, the Serenity from Firefly, the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars, the Enterprise from Star Trek, like whatever ship you can think of, whose crew would handle it best before losing their mind?
We left out the TARDIS and the Doctor because we've already...
That's not really a ship though, is it?
Yes, yeah, it's a ship.
Is it?
Yeah.
But that's also then we'd be dependent upon lots of other things.
I mean, can you imagine if this entity got a hold of the TARDIS's brain?
Oh, that'd be bad.
So that's what
I'm
saying.
Extra bad.
So I give you guys, do you guys need a second? Or you guys?
I can go with mine.
Okay.
In particular. So I'm going to go with them docking with the Serenity from Firefly. Simply because the shenanigans that would ensue seems absolutely wild. And the fact that River would probably try to get as many people off the ship as quickly as possible seems more probable. Like the likelihood of them actually trying to figure out what's going on and get out seems higher, though we would probably have issues with Jane trying to steal things. Makes sense. Book literally trying to be like, this is a cursed place. We got to go. Like everybody just get out. And then the question of Mal and if he's going to stick for the payday, which is very interesting because, like, the dichotomy and the family aspects of the Serenity crew is very interesting. And then in relation to the Event Horizon, like, if they picked up Sam Neill, I swear someone would have tried to boot him out, like, early. They just would have been like, bye, you're out. Like, no, this is your crazy ship. We won't leave you on your ship. Bye. If they just happened to dock up with the Event Horizon and they were trying to figure out what was going on, I think them as a unit would try to get away from the ship as quickly as possible, or someone would try to save everybody. Yeah, that's my particular take on this one. So I don't know. What about you, Spence? You got that deep thinking face.
Well, okay. So first off, I was playing through a scenario. What would happen with the Doctor? Because
yes,
I was thinking about it. I'm like, actually, I feel like this would just kind of end up to be a weird mixture of episodes that already happened, mm-hmm. which would be a combination of him dealing with that Midnight entity.
Yes.
And also the devil. Yep. One time he did that. That's what that would turn into. And I'm like, well, okay, he's probably someone who would probably actually do pretty well against this.
As long as there were no companions around.
Yeah, because they're dead.
Yep.
Or, you know,
they would have been dead immediately.
So if I hear what you're saying, so first off, if I heard what Amy's saying, everybody but River would ultimately die.
Yeah. And
I hear what you're saying, Spencer, everybody but the Doctor would die.
I mean, Wash could probably get away.
Wash already died. So
you never said what part of the timeline this is. So in my brain,
yeah, I was actually gonna go with Stargate Atlantis.
Yeah, because
that would have been really stupid and fun as like a horror premise for an episode for them. Mostly because it would have relied on one person to solve it while everyone else is in the background trying not to go crazy.
Yep.
Very consistent.
Very consistent. Improved.
I feel like, and I might have to steal this from Spencer, but I feel like the USS Enterprise.
Which one?
From First Contact.
Oh, the Enterprise E. Okay.
Because of the fact that we also wasn't it in this one where Data was starting to feel more?
Yeah.
So in the effort of not only the amount of personnel, which,
so you
know,
have more fodder.
You have more fodder.
Oh my gosh! You're
red shirts galore,
everywhere.
Baby. Red shirts galore.
I knew he was doing it.
But you also have the technology, not attached to the ship, to be able to detect and remove whatever this entity is.
Don't want Worf in there. I just want him to come out. Just come out, bud.
And I feel like at least the people on the bridge have a fair chance of surviving. Everyone else is dead.
Yeah.
But the people actually on the bridge.
Everybody.
Yes.
Picard has to go back to Starfleet. I need an entire new crew.
Exactly. Exactly.
Listen, something hooked up next to the ship and we barely got out.
We blew up the ship.
Yep. That exactly. Seems all right. I saved half of the mural.
Exactly. See, we're getting it. That does bring us to the part of the show where we do review whether the film passes or fails or how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
Knew this was coming.
Yes.
So unfortunately, to much of my chagrin, this film does pass. It has a beginning, middle, and an end. It does have a story, albeit one that I did not like for personal reasons of my own, mostly because I was traumatized the first time I saw this. And in going back on a second time, there were things that I was just like, no, thank you. Again, I didn't have an hour of cat videos this time, but it was about 20 minutes. It was okay because I watched this in the dark. Really, when it comes down to this story is something that leaves you with lots of questions, and it doesn't have a question of spirituality, but the question of what type of hell are we making when we experiment with things that, one, we don't understand, and two, we don't know. I think there's a line in the movie that says, like, you decided to mess with space, time, and physics, and you didn't think there would be consequences. The call out is very, very sound. Again, this is a very small crew cast that makes you feel really drawn in, which is something that when it comes down to more space horror, you find yourself becoming connected to this particular family. So all in all, while I still protest loudly watching this dang film again, as well as the rest of the cosmic horror films of this month. This one actually is going to get a 2.5. No. I'll give it a 3 because it actually really does earn a 3 out of 5 monocles. I'm just not watching it again. And if one of you makes me watch this again, I swear I will take out your toenails.
It's not going to be me.
It's not going to be you. Look across the table at Eddie.
Spencer.
Spencer with all your toenails.
Yeah, I'll keep those. This movie passes for me. It was a fun one. Like, again, so delightfully fun. Just got drawn right into it off the get-go. It wastes no time in just being like, okay, we're ready to go. Let's ramp up into the madness. Really, this movie gets like a 4 out of 5 for me. I really had fun.
There you go. Yeah. As far as myself, I agree with Spencer. The movie does pass for me. The story does have an engaging element. It keeps you on your toes, and it's absolutely within the vein of what you would expect out of cosmic horror and just sci-fi scariness, like everything that involves that. So as far as monocles, I am also going to give it, what'd you say, a 4 out of 5?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree. I'm going to have to give it a 4 out of 5 as well. This movie, Amy's shaking her head over there.
I'm going to shake my head. I appreciate that everyone has their own opinions, and much like butts, everyone stinks, including my own. But hey.
Okay. As far as like this movie, it is definitely a mark on the history of cinema as far as that turning point for where cosmic horror and space travel meet. I really did appreciate it. Appreciate all the performances in it. And honestly, it was a great watch. So I'm glad we got a chance to see it. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmosphers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmosphersPodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills and chills, spookity movies, and all that goodness. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmosphersPodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever we are on socials, whether if it's facebook.com/filmosphers or at Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmosophy101. And at Blue Sky at filmlossverspodcast.bluesky.social. Over at our Instagram page, that's where we post all of our other great offshoots, whether it's Spencer's Big Score or Amy's Jane Unseen, which can be found where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane Unseen on Instagram and Instagram only. And you guys, I'm so excited for Streaming is for Lovers. I just finished another one, and boy howdy, I'm only going to get a couple of you to watch this, mostly Spencer, maybe. But it's going to be like, I'm going to have to not clickbait it, but you'll be excited to hear about it too.
Yeah, it'll be very clickbaity.
It's not clickbaity, it's Netflix.
Also, you could check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, and iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune in to your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmosphers. Give us a like or a subscribe. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please. And don't make me do this anymore.
Have you seen... well, maybe. Have you seen Event Horizon? What are your thoughts on the movie? Did you get a chance to see it? Have you not? What spooky movies have you seen for the month of October? We'd love to hear your thoughts in the towel section down below. And of course, again, if you feel we've done a great job, give us that 5-star review. This was a great episode and a great conversation. And obviously, we will continue the celebration with one more week to go, as we have some really great things ready in the chamber to talk about when we launch the next few episodes. So we hope you will stay tuned and listen in. So from all of us here at the Filmosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm managing intern manager Amy, and I still don't want to do more cosmic horror, please.
Okay. From all of us here at the Filmosophers, class dismissed.
Look at that conversation starter.
No, that's not a conversation starter. That's just confusion.
So there was a main bodyguard on Jerry Springer show, and his name
was... We are not talking about
Jerry Seinfeld.
Obviously.
Nope. That's a bad thing.
Yes, Steve Wilkos. Yes.
Yes.
You added last names to that.
Because Steve Wilco, he didn't replace Jerry Springer. He was an offshoot to Jerry Springer.
Yeah, because he had his own show.
He had his own show.
Not at he, no, that they had a sound.
They offshot? No.
They Okay, I know what we're talking about. We're going live.
Is this the Bad Bunny Puerto Rico thing?
Three, two, and